Welcome to the Deep Dive, your shortcut to being well-informed. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst. We're here to guide you through today's edition of The Washington Post for Wednesday, September 3rd, 2025.
Yeah, and this paper is really packed today, a rich tapestry of our world right now. You know, stories from, well, major tech rulings all the way to global conflicts, domestic politics, and even shifts in, like, our cultural landscape.
That's right.
Our mission, as always, is to pull out the most important bits of knowledge and insight. We try to offer some surprising facts, maybe a little humor, just enough to keep you hooked. We really want to help you understand what's most important in these stories.
Exactly. We'll connect the dots, try to provide that crucial context, and really explore the why behind the headlines. We want to encourage you to think critically about, you know, the implications of the news you're consuming.
Think of us as your expert guides, basically.
That's the idea. Navigating today's big stories.
All right, let's unpack this then. Let's dive deep into what's shaking up the front page first. Okay, so we're kicking off with a truly huge decision. This could redefine the tech landscape for years. Google has averted a breakup in this landmark antitrust ruling.
Mm-hmm.
Remember last year, Judge Amit P. Mehta found Google held an illegal monopoly in online search. Well, now he's rejected the Justice Department's call to actually split the company up.
Yeah, it's pretty significant. Instead of a breakup, he's mandated a series of remedies, things designed to curb its power, but avoiding what he called a radical structural breakup.
What's really striking here, I think, is how reluctant the court seemed to be to, you know, structurally dismantle these huge, organically grown tech companies, even when a monopoly is proven.
Absolutely. Judge Mehta himself emphasized what he called judicial humility when crafting these remedies.
Mm.
He actually reminded everyone that the last major company broken up under Section 2 of the Sherman Act, that's the bit targeting monopolization, was AT&T.
Wow, way back in 1984.
Way back. So this isn't just, like, a win for Google. It kind of signals that future regulation might focus more on tweaking operations, you know, changing behavior, rather than outright breaking up corporate power.
Which is critical, especially as AI gets more and more powerful, right? It's consolidating influence.
Hugely important context, yeah.
So what are the actual remedies then? What did the judge order and what did the Justice Department want that got, well, turned down? Because there was a lot on the table, wasn't there?
Oh, absolutely. A whole menu of options. So what the court did order is that Google has to halt its multi-billion dollar exclusivity contracts. Those are the deals that basically force device makers to promote its search engine.
Okay, that sounds pretty big.
It is. And it also needs to share certain search index data with its rivals, which, again, could be significant depending on the details.
But the DOJ wanted more.
They did. Their more, let's say, aggressive proposals didn't make the cut. They wanted Google to show users a choice screen so you could easily pick other search engines.
Right. I remember that idea.
Yeah. And they wanted Google to share more granular data with advertisers or even fund a big national public education campaign about search options.
Mm.
And crucially, the prosecution's push for a forced divestiture of Google's Chrome browser, a really key asset that was denied. Judge Mehta basically said the Justice Department hadn't met the heavy burden to prove such a structural change was necessary.
Okay. So I imagine Google's executives are breathing a massive sigh of relief.
Well, for sure. And their stock certainly did. Jumped over 7% after the announcement.
But for you, the listener, what does this ruling truly mean for your daily digital life, your experience online? Is it actually going to foster more competition, or has Google basically gotten a green light to keep its powerful position, especially with AI becoming so integrated into search?
That is the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have industry groups like the Computer and Communications Industry Association welcoming the decision, saying, you know, it avoids disruption.
But the other side.
But antitrust advocates, people like Gene Kimmelman, who used to advise the Justice Department, they called it a disappointingly weak remedy.
Okay.
The core insight here, I think, is that while Google's competitive edges might have been blunted a little bit, its fundamental dominance seems to remain largely intact.
So the fear is?
The fear is that Google is still incredibly well positioned to control not just online search, but also this rapidly expanding market for artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And AI is becoming more and more intertwined with how we search for information.
Yeah.
So this ruling sets a precedent, maybe suggesting that even proven monopolies might just face operational adjustments, behavioral changes, rather than, you know, fundamental structural changes.
Yeah.
Which could leave consumers like you with limited choices in the long run.
Fascinating.
Ah.
Okay, let's shift gears now. moving from the digital battleground to, well, a very real and a harrowing one. Our next story takes us to the front lines in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
We often think of drones as weapons, right? But here, they're being used for something much more fundamental, survival.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Drones are now being widely used to deliver vital supplies, food, water, medicine, ammo, cigarettes, even calming herbs, apparently, delivering them to soldiers who are cut off in the trenches by relentless Russian surveillance.
It's this dark, almost unbelievable blend of ancient trench warfare and really cutting-edge modern technology. The conditions described in the article are just miserable.
Like World War I, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Troops often deploy expecting to be there for a few days, but they get stuck for a month or even more. Why? Because ground resupply is often just impossible. Too dangerous due to constant drone threats overhead.
Wow.
So these soldiers are left with, you know, basically just assault rifles, maybe machine guns, some grenades. This isn't just about military tech. It's really a testament to human ingenuity under the most incredibly dire circumstances.
And this is where the story gets intensely personal, I think. These Ukrainian drone units, sometimes they're even adapting agricultural drones, apparently.
Like the bigger ones.
And they're carrying impressive 40-pound payloads. They fly these missions at night, dropping packages directly to soldiers who are only visible via thermal cameras down in the trenches.
Imagine waiting for that drop.
Yeah, that mission complete signal. I mean, it must be one of the most welcome sounds in that desolate landscape. But there's a constant grave risk involved, right?
Always. Each drone delivery, each flight path, could potentially reveal a Ukrainian position.
Yeah.
Exposing those very troops they're trying to help to counterstrikes. So the immediate relief comes with this very real and immediate danger.
What really stands out, too, is the incredible human element here, the focus on morale that sort of underpins this whole technological adaptation.
Absolutely. Soldiers are preparing packages with familiar things, borscht, cabbage rolls, roasted chicken, a vital taste of home, you know.
Yeah.
The article mentions one soldier, Mikhailo, who asked for crossword puzzles. Another commander talked about a soldier requesting detective novels in Ukrainian.
Specifically in Ukrainian.
Specifically, yeah. To improve his language skills, not Russian ones. These aren't just supplies. They're critical lifelines. Small comforts that, you know, sustain people in these nightmarish conditions.
And the conditions are truly grim. Mikhailo's story, 38 days in a 130-square-foot position.
Unimaginable.
Using plastic bags for defecation, chlorine tablets for urine, burning hand sanitizer for warmth in winter, constant scanning for threats. It's horrific.
And then there's that tragic anecdote about Oleksandr. His friend, Tarakan, meaning cockroach, was buried alive under 6 feet of soil during a mortar attack.
Oh, God.
And Oleksandr was ordered to retreat, couldn't save him. Later, after that unimaginable horror, a drone dropped Snickers bars for the survivors.
Snickers bars.
Yeah. It's just this stark, almost surreal contrast that highlights the desperate need for even the smallest moments of, well, normalcy or relief amidst such brutality.
So this deep dive into Ukraine's drone resupply efforts, it really shows a critical adaptation in modern warfare, doesn't it? Showcasing both the tech innovation and just the enduring human struggle in conflict.
It does.
Yeah.
And the broader insight, maybe, is how these small acts of humanity, delivered by this cutting-edge tech, become vital not just for physical survival, but for the psychological resilience of the soldiers.
Yeah.
It's a powerful illustration of the lengths people go to preserve dignity and hope when, you know, everything else is being stripped away.
Okay. Our final front page story brings us back home to domestic politics, specifically in D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser has decided to prolong indefinite cooperation with federal law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. An executive order.
Exactly. Requiring local coordination with federal agencies to the maximum extent allowable by law and, crucially, with no expiration date. This really signals her willingness to cooperate with President Trump's public safety efforts here in the Capitol, a move that carries, well, significant weight.
It really forces us to confront D.C.'s unique political status, doesn't it? And that ongoing tension around home rule, because this isn't just like routine cooperation between agencies. The context is this backdrop of, well, unprecedented federal incursions into local affairs under the Trump administration, federalizing local police, deploying the National Guard, even using ICE agents in D.C. operations.
Right.
So Bowser's approach, which she apparently described as an olive branch, it stands in really sharp contrast to other Democratic mayors in big cities who are actively pushing back against similar threats or directives from the White House.
So the insight is?
I think the underlying insight is this pragmatic, maybe politically driven decision to align with federal power, even if it means potentially compromising local autonomy.
It's clear the administration was pleased. The article says Bowser even shared draft language of the order with White House officials beforehand.
Right, and she publicly credited Trump's efforts for decreasing crime.
And Trump himself lauded her on Truth Social, didn't he? Saying, we don't have a crime problem in Washington anymore, which is quite a statement.
It is. But this strategy is politically risky for Bowser, you'd have to think. D.C. is overwhelmingly Democratic. 92% of voters supported Kamala Harris in the last election.
Yeah.
And some council members have already publicly broken with her over this. They're arguing that Washingtonians want decisions guided by community values, not federal overreach.
So the broader implication here is about that tightrope local leaders have to walk, especially under federal pressure, and particularly in a city like D.C. without full statehood.
Exactly. This move, while maybe it seems pragmatic for Bowser in the short term, it could come with substantial political and philosophical costs for her constituents. It really raises that crucial question about the extent to which local control can be overridden by federal priorities.
And how communities can assert their values when facing such powerful external pressure.
It highlights a core tension in American federalism, really amplified by D.C.'s unique lack of full sovereignty.
Okay, shifting now to more actions and reactions specifically from the Trump administration. First up, we have a federal judge's ruling that sharply reprimanded the administration for using National Guard troops during immigration actions in Los Angeles, deemed it illegal.
Right. And almost in the same breath, President Trump signaled his intention to send the National Guard to Chicago. So really escalating tensions between federal and local authorities.
Yeah, this story really highlights that ongoing clash, doesn't it? Federal power versus state and local authority over domestic law enforcement. And, you know, the very contentious role of the military on U.S. soil.
Definitely. Judge Breyer in L.A. found the administration violated the Posse Comitatus Act. That's the law limiting military involvement in civilian law enforcement.
Okay.
Now, his ruling was, quote, narrowly tailored. It specifically blocked troops from doing things like making arrests, conducting searches, security patrols, traffic control. But, and this is important, he also stayed his own ruling until September 12th, expecting an appeal.
And he didn't order the troops out.
Crucially, no. The ruling did not order the remaining 300 or so troops to be withdrawn from L.A. They can stay in place, for now at least. That nuance is vital.
And Trump's reaction? Yeah. Predictable.
Pretty much. He quickly dismissed Judge Breyer as a radical left judge. But at the same time, he emphasized that the ruling didn't force the troops out, saying, quote, they can continue to be in place.
Meanwhile, in California, Governor Newsom and Attorney General Bonta strongly denounced the deployments, right? Calling them inflammatory, a threat to civil liberties.
Yeah, they argued military forces were, quote, pervasively intertwined with civilian law enforcement activities. It really does sound like a constitutional showdown brewing there.
And now the focus shifts to Chicago.
Right. Trump declared, we're going in, calling Chicago the worst and most dangerous city in the world and the murder capital of the world, all caps, of course.
He cited the recent Labor Day weekend shootings.
He did. 9 killed, 52 injured. But Chicago's Mayor Johnson and Illinois Governor Pritzker immediately rejected this idea of a military occupation.
What are they saying?
They're urging residents to, quote, film things you see happening and be loud for America. They argue Trump should focus on stemming the flow of illegal guns from red states instead of sending troops.
And the data versus the rhetoric.
Well, that's a key insight here. There's a disparity. While Chicago does have high absolute numbers of homicides, its actual murder rate places it outside the top 20 U.S. cities. And violent crime there has actually decreased 23% this year, according to the article.
So it highlights that selective use of data in political narratives.
Exactly. The broader insight from this deep dive is how this conflict over federal intervention really impacts our understanding of state sovereignty, the rule of law. It forces a critical look at how crime stats are deployed in political rhetoric, often to justify these broad federal actions that local leaders see as a major overreach.
It's the tension again, federal desire for control versus local claims of self-governance.
Precisely.
Okay, next. President Trump announced he's relocating the U.S. Space Command headquarters, moving it from Colorado Springs, Colorado, to Huntsville, Alabama.
Ah, yes. Another chapter in this long-running saga. This has been a partisan battle for years going back and forth.
So what's the history here?
Well, the Air Force actually preferred Huntsville back in 2021, but then the Biden administration chose to keep it in Colorado Springs in 2023. With Trump back in office, a reversal seemed likely, especially with support from Alabama lawmakers like Representative Mike Rogers.
And Trump's rationale for the move now?
He framed it as a common-sense choice for national security, citing Huntsville's existing aerospace infrastructure.
Yeah.
You know, Redstone Arsenal, NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center.
Makes sense on the surface.
It does. But he also threw in a comment about Colorado's mail-in voting being a big problem, which adds a distinct political flavor to the decision.
And how is Colorado reacting? Not well, I assume.
Not well at all. The entire Colorado congressional delegation, including Trump ally Representative Lauren Boebert, condemned the decision. They argued it sets our space defense apparatus back years, wastes billions of taxpayer dollars, and hands the advantage to the converging threats of China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea. Strong words.
Wow. And the economic impact for Colorado.
Significant. The Denver Metro Chamber of Commerce projected the move would cost Colorado about 1,400 jobs and around $1 billion in economic activity.
So Space Command's role, remind us what they actually do.
They coordinate U.S. military activities in space, things like satellite communications, defending government satellites, missile defense. And its importance has only grown as space becomes this critical area for military competition, especially with China's rapid advances.
So the implication here is that this move is seen as highly politicized.
Very much so, with significant economic fallout for Colorado and these potentially serious national security ramifications being raised by critics.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of national security, what does this tell us about that intersection of politics, defense, and economic development? It seems pretty tangled.
Extremely tangled. It shows how major defense decisions, even about where to locate a headquarters, can become deeply enmeshed in partisan politics and regional economic competition, potentially overshadowing purely strategic considerations.
All right, let's turn to another ongoing story. The Jeffrey Epstein case. The House Oversight Committee has released its first batch of documents related to Epstein.
Mm-hmm. And at the same time, Senator Ron Wyden is ramping up bipartisan pressure on Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent.
Pressure for what?
To release financial files specifically, suspicious activity reports, or SARs related to Epstein's finances.
Okay, so what was in this first batch of documents from the House committee? Anything new?
Well, the committee, led by Chairman James Comer, subpoenaed the Justice Department for these. But a Washington Post analysis found that at least two-thirds of the documents initially released were actually already publicly available court documents.
So not a huge bombshell there yet.
Not in this initial release, it seems. But the investigation is ongoing. Republicans and Democrats alike are pushing for more transparency, despite President Trump apparently calling for people to move on.
Right. The committee's also requested interviews from high-profile figures from previous administrations, hasn't it? Like Bill and Hillary Clinton, former FBI Director James Comey.
They have, casting a wide net. But the focus on the financial side, particularly from Senator Wyden, seems really key right now.
Why are these SARs, these suspicious activity reports, so important?
Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon, accuses Treasury Secretary Bessent of being directly responsible for the decision to withhold the Epstein files from Congress. Wyden's previous investigations apparently found records of payments and suspicious wire transfers linked to Epstein.
And the SARs themselves.
Wyden highlights that just one SAR showed over 4,725 wire transfers, totaling $1.08 billion among Epstein and his associates.
Wow.
So these files are seen as crucial for potentially tracking down more individuals who might have been involved in Epstein's sex trafficking network. They follow the money trail.
And this is a bipartisan push.
Wyden emphasizes that point. Quote, "Thorough vetting of Epstein's finances and his sex trafficking network should not be a partisan issue, underscoring that demand for transparency and accountability for the victims, even years after Epstein's death."
So the implication here is this ongoing bipartisan effort to uncover the full scope of Epstein's activities, hold everyone involved accountable, but facing challenges with government transparency.
Exactly. And it raises that important question, you know, about how long investigations into such high-profile, complex figures should continue and what role the public has in demanding full accountability.
Okay, shifting gears again within the administration's sphere, President Trump announced he plans to award Rudy Giuliani the Presidential Medal of Freedom.
Yes, the nation's highest civilian honor for his longtime ally and the former New York mayor.
What was Trump's justification?
He praised Giuliani on Truth Social, calling him the greatest mayor in the history of New York City and an equally great American patriot.
And the timing. Didn't Giuliani just have an accident?
Yes. The announcement came just days after Giuliani was injured in a car crash up in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Fractured his vertebra, apparently.
Now, Giuliani's role has obviously been pretty controversial, especially in recent years.
Extremely. He was a fierce defender of Trump. Through three campaigns, two impeachments, he led Trump's legal challenges against the 2020 election results, challenges that were, you know, widely found to be baseless by judges across the country.
And there were legal consequences for him personally, weren't there?
Absolutely. His work as Trump's personal lawyer led to his disbarment in New York in 2024. And just this January, he settled for an undisclosed amount with two Georgia election workers he had defamed. That was after a jury in 2023 had ordered him to pay them a staggering $148 million.
So, awarding him this medal, how does that compare to past awards?
Well, the article points out the contrast. Former President Joe Biden awarded the medal to critics of Trump, including Hillary Clinton and George Soros. It really highlights how politicized this particular honor has become in recent years.
So the implication is that this decision will undoubtedly be seen as highly polarizing.
Absolutely. It reflects loyalty within political circles, for sure, but it also raises questions about the criteria for such a prestigious award in the current climate.
Yeah, it really makes you think about how we perceive the awarding of national honors now. What's the balance between, say, political service, past achievements, and more recent conduct or controversies?
It's a complex question with no easy answers, clearly.
Okay, another appointment causing some waves. E.J. Antoni, President Trump's nominee to lead the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS. He apparently discussed a pretty contentious theory about gender and IQ last year.
Yeah, this is sparking concern. Antoni, who's currently the chief economist at the Conservative Heritage Foundation, reportedly discussed this controversial scientific theory about inherent differences in intellect between men and women with interns at the think tank.
What exactly did he say, according to the report?
He reportedly told the interns that women's IQs generally cluster around average scores, while men's IQs vary more widely, resulting in more men at both the high end, the geniuses, and the low end of intelligence. This is commonly known as the greater male variability hypothesis.
And this theory has a history, doesn't it?
A very controversial one. Lawrence Summers, when he was president of Harvard back in 2005, faced intense scrutiny for making similar remarks, and it was a significant factor contributing to his eventual resignation. So it carries a lot of baggage.
What does the Heritage Foundation say about Antoni's remarks?
A spokesperson stated that Antoni cited statistics when asked about workforce issues and denied he needed to apologize for his presentation. They also said the organization doesn't have an official position on gender IQ differences.
But beyond the controversial remarks themselves, there are also concerns about his qualifications for the BLS job specifically.
Yes, some economists have raised that point. Traditionally, BLS leaders are seen as, you know, deep statistical experts with extensive peer-reviewed academic publications. Antoni apparently has only one listed his doctoral dissertation.
And the White House stance?
White House spokeswoman Taylor Rogers stated that Antoni will make decisions by evaluating the objective statistics and will restore America's trust in the BLS. So they're backing him, emphasizing his focus on objective data moving forward.
So the implications here. This appointment and the surrounding discussion raise critical questions, don't they, about the role of scientific theories, especially controversial ones, in policymaking.
Definitely. And about the qualifications needed for leadership in these crucial data-driven government agencies. And ultimately, the potential impact on public trust in official statistics, which is so fundamental.
It really makes you consider how important a nominee's academic background and their past statements are for a role like head of the BLS. How do you weigh those things?
It's a tough balance. It highlights how even seemingly objective agencies like the BLS can become subjects of political and ideological debate through the appointment process.
Okay, one more from the administration front. Legal and whistleblower experts are asserting that the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, violated federal law last week.
How so?
By placing over 30 Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, employees on administrative leave. And this happened just about 36 hours after they signed an open letter of dissent.
Wow, that timing seems pointed.
Yeah.
What was the letter about?
It was called the Katrina Declaration. More than 190 current and former FEMA employees signed it. They were criticizing their current leader's inexperience and approach, warning of a potential disaster on the scale of Hurricane Katrina if things didn't change.
So, a serious warning from within the agency itself. And the response was to put them on leave.
Many of those who signed with their real names, yes, put on indefinite administrative leave. The notice apparently stated it was not a disciplinary action and not intended to be punitive.
But the experts disagree.
Strongly. The Government Accountability Project and other nonprofits argue this action was clearly illegal retaliation under federal law. They say it significantly and adversely changed the workers' conditions by basically barring them from their jobs right after they made these protected disclosures.
So the argument is that DHS can't prove they would have done this anyway, regardless of the letter.
Exactly. Experts contend DHS would fail to prove it would have taken the same action in the absence of such disclosure, suggesting a leave was directly linked to the letter.
And this isn't the first time something like this has happened recently.
No, the article notes it follows similar actions earlier this summer against nearly 140 EPA employees who also wrote a letter of dissent. Some of them were subsequently fired.
So the implications here are pretty serious, aren't they? Concerns about whistleblower protections within the federal government, freedom of speech for employees.
Absolutely. And the potential impact on critical agencies like FEMA, especially given their role in public safety and disaster response, if experts are afraid to speak out about potential risks.
That's a huge problem. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it really highlights the challenges of internal dissent within government agencies, especially in the current climate, and underscores the importance of safeguarding the ability of experts to, well, sound the alarm without fear of retaliation.
Okay, let's turn our attention now to global affairs. We're starting with a truly devastating humanitarian crisis unfolding in Afghanistan. A recent earthquake has killed over 1,400 people, and sadly, the toll is expected to rise significantly.
It's just awful news. And in the midst of this tragedy, the Taliban are calling for international aid. But it's complicated. Recent Western funding cuts are severely hampering the disaster response efforts on the ground.
It immediately presents this incredibly complex moral and logistical challenge, doesn't it? How do you balance the urgent humanitarian needs of people suffering with these deep-seated, valid concerns about supporting the Taliban regime?
It's a terrible dilemma. Rescuers are struggling just to reach remote areas blocked by landslides. Entire villages have been flattened in Konar province, according to the report.
And the aid infrastructure is crippled.
Severely. The UN Humanitarian Air Service helicopter, which is absolutely crucial for reaching those remote areas, is apparently grounded. Why? Because of drastic funding cuts over the past 6 months.
Wow.
To put that in perspective, the U.S. alone used to provide nearly 60% of the global funding for emergency shelters in Afghanistan. The scale of the human suffering is immense, but the delivery of help is just deeply tangled up in politics.
And the Taliban's isolation, their political situation, plays a huge direct role in making this crisis worse.
Absolutely. Despite their spokesperson explicitly saying, quote, "We definitely need international humanitarian aid," the regime's continued international isolation is largely down to their extreme gender segregation policies.
Banning female education, public workers.
Right. And those policies directly hinder the response efforts. Female experts who are vital in these situations are suspended from the public sector. International aid organizations face tightened, often contradictory rules about their female staffers.
The article even mentioned reports of women losing critical time trying to put on hijabs during previous disasters, even as their homes were collapsing.
Horrifying stories, yeah. It underscores the severe practical impact of these policies on humanitarian access and just basic aid effectiveness.
So how are Western governments justifying the aid cuts?
Well, the White House apparently justified U.S. cuts by stating that aid would be, quote, routinely confiscated by the Taliban. Other donors, France, Sweden, Britain, have also significantly reduced their assistance.
And the broader impact beyond the immediate earthquake zone.
It's dire across the board. Hospitals face medicine shortages. The World Food Program, which relies heavily on U.S. funding, can now only support about 1 million of the 10 million Afghans they identify as being in urgent need of food aid.
So the core insight here is just the devastating human cost when humanitarian aid needs collide head-on with geopolitical isolation. It exacerbates a crisis in an already incredibly vulnerable nation.
It's a stark reminder, isn't it, that political decisions about aid, made thousands of miles away, have immediate life-or-death consequences for millions of ordinary people.
Okay, moving from natural disasters to political trials, a really significant story is unfolding in Brazil. The trial of former President Jair Bolsonaro has begun.
Yes, and it started with a pointed statement from a Supreme Court justice defending the independence of the proceeding from foreign interference, which everyone understood as a clear, though unnamed, reference to President Trump's attempts to influence the case.
So this narrative immediately highlights a concerning global trend, doesn't it? The spread of these political tactics that challenge democratic processes and how international figures can try to exert influence on national legal systems.
Very much so. Bolsonaro, the right-wing former army officer, is accused of some incredibly serious things, planning a military coup to stay in power after he lost the 2022 election, including, apparently, a plot to assassinate his successor, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva.
Wow, so this is a profound test for Brazil's democratic institutions.
Absolutely critical. And it's not just an internal Brazilian affair, as you mentioned. Trump, who's a known Bolsonaro ally, has openly called the prosecution a witch hunt. He even went so far as to order economic and diplomatic sanctions to try and pressure Brazilian officials into dropping the case.
And the justice responded directly.
Justice Alexandre Moraes did, yeah. Though without naming Trump, he referred pointedly into another foreign state's attempts to obstruct the process. The whole situation has these really eerie echoes of January 6th here in the U.S., doesn't it?
It really does. Bolsonaro's supporters stormed Brazil's capital on January 8, 2023, just a week after Lula's inauguration. Very similar imagery to the U.S. Capitol attack.
The parallels are hard to ignore.
So what are the specific charges Bolsonaro faces, and what kind of sentence?
The charges are heavy. Leading a criminal organization, attempting to abolish democratic rule of law, and attempting a coup d'etat. He faces a potential sentence of up to 40 years if convicted. And it's not just him. Seven other former officials and military officers are also on trial alongside him.
What's the evidence prosecutors are citing?
They apparently have a draft presidential decree that would have granted Bolsonaro emergency powers, allowed him to seize the electoral courts, and change the election results. And perhaps most chillingly, this alleged plan to assassinate Lula, the Vice President Geraldo Alckmin, and Justice Moraes himself.
Just incredible accusations. What did Justice Moraes say about the significance for Brazil?
He stated that this prosecution could be a real turning point for Brazil. He emphasized that true national conciliation depends on respect for the Constitution and legal accountability. This is significant because Brazil has historically tended towards political conciliation rather than legal reckoning after previous coup attempts or political crises.
So the insight here is really the critical role of the judiciary in trying to uphold democratic principles against intense political pressure, both domestic and foreign.
Exactly. It's a testament to both the fragility and potentially the resilience of democratic institutions, not just in Brazil, but globally.
Okay, let's shift focus to Europe now, specifically the UK. Britain is embroiled in a bitter political fight over its government's reliance on hotels to house tens of thousands of asylum seekers.
Yeah, this has really ignited protests, legal battles, and a much broader, very heated debate on immigration policy there.
What's the scale of the issue? How many people are we talking about?
The article says approximately 32,000 asylum seekers are currently housed in over 200 hotels across the country. The root cause is a severely backlogged asylum system. They had a record 111,000 people apply for asylum in the past year alone, and about 40% of those arrived via small boats crossing the English Channel.
And this has enraged people on both sides of the political spectrum.
Completely. On the political right, you have calls for mass deportations. Nigel Farage, for instance, has a plan targeting 600,000 undocumented migrants. But on the other side, advocates for migrants deem the hotels totally untenable. There was a report by Migrant Voice citing poor conditions, like filthy rooms and food smelling rancid.
Are there legal challenges happening too?
Yes. A recent court ruling actually overturned an injunction against a hotel in a town called Epping, allowing it to continue housing asylum seekers. But over a dozen local governments had apparently been weighing options to oppose the use of hotels in their areas.
And public safety concerns have flared up.
Unfortunately, yes. Tensions really boiled over after an asylum seeker staying at that Bell Hotel in Epping was charged with sexually assaulting a teenage girl. That led to anti-migrant protests, some of which apparently turned violent.
So how is the government responding? It's a Labour government now under Keir Starmer.
They've promised to end the use of hotels for asylum seekers, but not until 2029. They also plan to overhaul the asylum appeal system and reduce the backlog. One controversial measure is halving the time asylum seekers have to find new housing once their claim is processed. from 56 days down to 28.
And the article draws parallels to the situation here in the U.S.
It does, noting that this unfolds just as President Trump is ramping up immigration crackdowns here, and polling in the U.K. suggests nearly half of Britons actually support mass deportations. So there's a hardening of attitudes, it seems.
The implication here is that this debate really reveals these deep societal divisions over immigration, public resources, national identity.
Absolutely, with significant political and, of course, humanitarian consequences. If we connect it to the bigger picture, it just underscores this universal challenge that many countries are facing.
Yeah.
How to manage migration and asylum humanely and effectively in a globalized world. And the powerful emotions it stirs up within national communities.
Okay, one more international story with a strong U.S. connection. A U.S. military strike in the Caribbean Sea killed 11 people on Tuesday.
Yes, and President Trump claimed they were narco-terrorists from the Tren de Aragua gang, or TDA, which he alleges is affiliated with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro.
What was Trump's justification for the strike? How did he announce it?
He announced it on social media, even posting imagery of the vessel exploding. He stated the, quote, terrorists were at sea in international waters transporting illegal narcotics heading to the United States. He declared it a, quote, notice to anybody even thinking about bringing drugs into the United States of America. Beware. Again, all caps.
So this marks a pretty dramatic escalation, doesn't it? Is this the first time they've used deadly force like this?
It seems to be the first known time the Trump administration has used deadly force specifically to target illicit drug shipments coming from Latin America. It definitely aligns with their heightened focus on counter-narcotics and also that intensifying feud with Venezuela's Maduro.
But is the intelligence clear on the connection between Maduro and this TDA gang?
That's where it gets murky. The article cites a secret U.S. intelligence assessment from back in April, which apparently stated Maduro's government probably does not have a policy of cooperating with TDA and doesn't direct its U.S. operations. In fact, it said Maduro likely views the gang as a security threat himself.
So that contradicts Trump's claims, the ones used to justify invoking the Alien Enemies Act against alleged TDA members earlier.
It appears to, yes. It presents a conflicting picture.
Has Maduro responded yet?
The Venezuelan government hadn't made an immediate comment at the time the article was published. However, Maduro has previously denounced the heightened U.S. military presence in the Caribbean, calling it an extravagant, unjustified, immoral, and absolute criminal threat.
What about the broader context of drug trafficking from Venezuela?
Well, Venezuela has been accused of facilitating drug trafficking, and there are some reports indicating cocaine production there, but it's not considered a major producer like, say, Colombia. The extent of its role in U.S.-bound cocaine traffic is somewhat unclear, according to the article.
But the U.S. has targeted Maduro directly before, haven't they?
Oh, yes. The U.S. designated the Cartel de los Soles, which they say is headed by Maduro, as a terrorist and drug trafficking organization. And they doubled the reward for Maduro's arrest to $50 million.
What are experts saying about this latest strike?
Experts quoted, like Phil Gunson from the International Crisis Group, view the strike as part of a campaign of intimidation. He anticipates Maduro will use it to accuse the U.S. of imperialist intervention. Another expert, Anthony Byman, noted it's a significant shift towards a much more militarized approach to counter-narcotics.
So the implication is that this strike represents a major shift in U.S. strategy, with high geopolitical tensions and potential for further escalation in the region.
Absolutely. It really raises that critical question. In the fight against drug trafficking, where is the line between interdiction-stopping drugs and international military intervention? And how do we, as observers, assess these very different narratives surrounding events like this?
Okay, let's move into the economy and innovation, cultural commentary now. Seeing some big shifts in the food industry, Kraft Heinz just announced it's splitting into two separate companies.
Yeah, big news. The goal is apparently to better respond to changing consumer preferences, really moving away from some of those heavily processed foods and trying to adapt to new economic realities.
So this strategic divestment, it really highlights the intense pressure these legacy food brands are under, doesn't it? They have to innovate, they have to adapt to these rapidly evolving consumer tastes and health trends.
Completely. What's driving it? Well, it's a broader trend. Consumers, especially, you know, Gen Z and millennials, they're increasingly price conscious. They're spending less on dining out. They're opting for more private label or store brands.
And looking for less processed food generally.
Exactly. And then you throw in the rising use of those weight loss drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy. That's apparently cutting into sales of traditional snacks and sugary drinks too. So these legacy brands are being forced to fundamentally rethink their whole portfolio.
So how is the split actually working? What goes where?
Okay, so one company will focus on sauces, spreads, and seasonings. Think Heinz ketchup, Philadelphia cream cheese, Kraft mac and cheese, kind of the core comfort foods, maybe.
Right.
The other company, which will be led by the current CEO, Carlos Abrams Rivera, will include brands like Oscar Mayer, Kraft Singles, and Lunchables. More of the refrigerated and convenience items, perhaps.
Hadn't Kraft Heinz already tried to adapt somewhat?
They had. The article mentions they introduced less sugar Capri Sun hot dogs without artificial preservatives. They have plans to remove artificial colors by 2027. But despite these efforts, well, their stock tumbled 7% after the split announcement.
Ouch! And it's been struggling for a while.
Yeah, the stock is down over 60% since the big Kraft and Heinz merger back in 2015. That merger was ironically aimed at reviving their fortunes, combining forces.
And this isn't an isolated incident in the food world.
Not at all. It mirrors similar moves by other giants like Curry, Dr. Pepper, Kellogg's. They've also split up or spun off parts of their businesses. It suggests a broader industry shift towards, as the article puts it, thinking small, focusing on core, high-growth products rather than trying to be everything to everyone.
So what are the experts saying?
Well, one expert, Hank Cardello, called the initial merger a little less than two, implying it didn't create the value expected. Another expert suggests there's a real need now for totally new products tailored to GLP-1 users, those taking the new weight loss drugs or young consumers who prefer, you know, grazing or snacking to traditional meals.
So the core insight is that even these established giants have to constantly reinvent themselves to stay relevant. The market's driven by these rapidly changing lifestyles and health priorities.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? What will your grocery cart or maybe your food delivery order look like in another 5 years?
Yeah. So what does this all mean for you as a consumer? Will this lead to healthier, maybe more diverse options on the grocery store shelves? Or is it just more corporate maneuvering? Something to watch.
Okay, let's pivot now to the world of work and technology, specifically how job seekers can navigate the rise of artificial intelligence. There's an article outlining 5 ways people can improve their AI literacy.
Yeah, this is becoming increasingly important, isn't it? Employers are looking for AI fluency across almost all job functions now, not just in technical roles.
So it's not just for coders anymore?
Not at all. It's becoming essential for content creation, marketing, customer service, project management, you name it. Companies want people who are, quote, AI literate or proactive users of these tools.
Okay, so what are the practical tips offered in the article? How can someone actually develop and showcase these skills? All right, 5 key things. First, familiarize yourself with the main tools out there. Get to know the big applications like OpenAI's ChatGPT, Anthropic's Claude, Google's Gemini, Microsoft's Copilot, and also the image and video generators Midjourney, Adobe Firefly, Google VO3. Just play around with them.
Okay, get hands-on. What's next?
Second, experiment liberally. Use AI for your own personal tasks, planning a vacation, making grocery lists, whatever. The idea is to understand its value, but also, crucially, its limitations. Think of it, the article suggests, as an intern that needs your guidance and judgment.
I like that analogy. Number 3.
Take formal courses. There are tons of free or paid options on online learning platforms like Coursera, Google, and Microsoft have courses there. Udemy, LinkedIn Learning, even YouTube tutorials. And ironically, AI itself can help teach you AI.
Right. Okay. 4.
Create a journal or portfolio. Document your AI experiments. What tools did you use? What prompts worked well? What were the outcomes? This gives you something tangible to show potential employers, demonstrating your experience in critical thinking about AI.
Makes sense. And the last one, number 5.
Update your resume. Explicitly add AI to your skills section. List any certifications you get. And maybe even highlight successful ways you've used AI in the descriptions of your past jobs or projects. This helps you get noticed by both human recruiters and those AI screening systems they use.
So the future outlook is AI literacy is going from a nice to have to a must have.
Pretty much. The article suggests that while right now it might be a differentiator, AI literacy is expected to become a standard skill, much like, you know, knowing how to use Microsoft Word is today. You just assume people have it.
The implication is clear then. The rapid integration of AI is fundamentally reshaping the job market. It demands new skills, new approaches from everyone in the workforce.
Absolutely. So the question for you, the listener, is how relevant is your current skill set to this AI-driven future? What steps are you taking or could you take to embrace the change, as they say, and effectively market your fluency in AI?
Now, staying in the business world, but shifting to corporate leadership, Nestlé, the world's largest food company, has dismissed its chief executive, Laurent Freyss.
Yes, this happened following an investigation into an undisclosed romantic relationship he apparently had with a direct subordinate.
So the dismissal was immediate.
Effective immediately, according to the report. They've named a longtime executive, Philippe Navratil, as the new CEO.
Freyss hadn't been in the top job that long, had he?
No, he'd only recently replaced the previous CEO, Mark Schneider. And Freyss had publicly stated his intention to refocus Nestlé on its core business products, things like coffee, pet care, food. And he'd actually criticized his predecessor's moves into areas like health supplements.
How has the company been performing recently?
Facing some headwinds. Nestlé reported a 10% drop in net profit for the first half of 2025. Challenges cited include tariffs and foreign exchange fluctuations.
So the reason for the dismissal, it was the undisclosed nature of the relationship rather than the relationship itself.
That seems to be the key point, yes. Typically, in these corporate situations, it's the lack of disclosure, the potential conflict of interest, or the violation of company policy regarding relationships with subordinates, rather than the relationship per se, that triggers action. It highlights the strict governance standards expected for top executives in major global companies.
So the implication here really underscores the critical importance of corporate governance, ethical conduct, transparency, especially for leaders of these huge global conglomerates.
Absolutely. It raises that important question for all of us, really. What level of transparency and ethical conduct do we expect from leaders of major corporations? And what are the ripple effects on trust, on morale, on the brand when those expectations aren't met?
Okay, let's move into the opinions section now and some cultural reflections. First up, a fascinating piece titled, What a Wi-Fi Ban Cost This West Virginia School.
Yes, Green Bank, West Virginia. The town that's been in the national radio quiet zone since 1958 because of the big radio observatory there. No Wi-Fi allowed.
Until now, right. They've finally allowed it within a 10-mile radius of the town. And the article argues this reveals the significant educational costs of that long-standing ban.
It really served as this, quote, unintentional experiment in pedagogy, didn't it? The local school was basically stuck in a 1999 tech environment while the rest of the country, well, zoomed ahead.
And the educational impact was measurable.
Apparently, yes. Students there consistently posted the lowest test scores in the county, particularly in math and reading. They couldn't use Chromebooks, digital textbooks, online research tools. Things we take for granted.
Even basic teaching tasks were harder.
Yeah. Teachers struggled with things like online individualized education programs, IEPs, or even just using Google Docs collaboratively. Standardized testing was a huge challenge. They had to rotate students through this small, hardwired computer lab because there was no wireless access.
And the pandemic must have really highlighted the issue.
Absolutely. The shift to remote learning during COVID underscored the critical need for home wireless connectivity, intensifying pressure to change the rules in the quiet zone.
Did they explore other solutions before allowing Wi-Fi?
They did. Ideas like Li-Fi, which uses light bulbs for low-range connectivity, were apparently too finicky and expensive. And building a giant dirt mound to block signals from the school would have destroyed their soccer fields.
So why the policy shift now?
The observatory cited increasing radio pollution from unauthorized wireless routers that people were sneaking in anyway, and also the school's persistent, long-standing requests for access. It seems they finally reached a tipping point.
And the principal's hope now?
Principal Melissa Jordan hopes Wi-Fi will finally allow her students to, quote, plug into the same opportunities as everyone else, though she acknowledges the teachers will need significant training to catch up.
This story really powerfully illustrates the fundamental role digital connectivity plays in modern education, doesn't it? And the huge challenges faced by communities left behind.
It does. What's fascinating here is that inherent trade-off between, you know, a major scientific pursuit, the radio observatory, and the basic well-being and educational needs of the local community. How much are we willing to sacrifice or ask communities to sacrifice for technological advancement elsewhere? And where do we draw the line for essential needs like education?
Okay, next opinion piece takes on conservation policy. The counterproductive bureaucratic logic on grizzly bears.
Yes. This argues that even though grizzly bear populations in the northern Rockies have recovered significantly, even exceeding population goals, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service denied requests to delist them from the Endangered Species Act protections.
And the authors argue the reasoning was counterproductive.
Exactly. They see it as flawed bureaucratic logic. Let's look at the success story first. The grizzly population in that area grew from maybe 700 bears back in 1975 when they were listed as threatened to over 2,300 today.
That's a huge increase.
Massive. And they've expanded their range into areas they haven't been seen in for over a century. This recovery cost nearly $200 million in state and federal investment between 1994 and 2020 alone. So, by many measures, a real conservation success.
But the Fish and Wildlife Service denied requests from Montana and Wyoming to delist the bears in the Greater Yellowstone and Northern Continental Divide areas. Why?
This is where the bureaucratic logic comes in, according to the authors. Wow. The agency's rationale was basically, these distinct populations had recovered so well and expanded their range so widely that they should no longer be considered distinct and separate population segments.
Wait, so because they recovered and spread out, they can't be delisted?
Essentially, yes. By grouping these recovered populations with other grizzly populations elsewhere that haven't recovered as well, the agency decided the overall species designation should remain threatened.
How do the authors critique that decision?
They argue this completely redefines recovery, moves the goalposts, and effectively diluted the recovered populations by lumping them in with others. They call it frustrating and counterproductive to the goals of the Endangered Species Act.
Why counterproductive? What are the negative incentives?
Their point is that refusing to delist successfully recovered populations disincentivizes future recovery efforts. If states and landowners see that success just leads to indefinite federal oversight anyway, why invest the time and money? It potentially diminishes the legitimacy and effectiveness of the act itself.
So what's their proposed solution?
They urge the Fish and Wildlife Service to revise its regulations, allow states to manage these recovered populations, enabling a gradual transition back to state management, which was always the intended endpoint of the act.
So the implication here is that this case highlights the complexities of species conservation, the potential for bureaucratic hurdles to actually undermine successful efforts.
Exactly. And that ongoing debate over federal versus state management of wildlife. If we connect it to the bigger picture, it really asks, when a species recovers, do we celebrate that success and adapt the policy accordingly? Or does the system sometimes get stuck in what the authors call endless federal purgatory? How do we ensure conservation efforts remain effective and actually incentivize progress?
Okay, another opinion piece defending something many people find, annoying. Those annoying pharmaceutical ads have real value.
The direct-to-consumer drug ads on TV. This editorial argues against proposals by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to limit them.
What is RFK Jr. proposing?
He's considering requiring longer, maybe more expensive warnings in the ads,
yeah,
and also preventing drug companies from deducting their advertising costs as business expenses. These ideas align with his broader Make America Healthy Again platform, which generally seeks to reduce reliance on pharmaceuticals.
And the common criticism of these ads is
that they encourage people to ask for expensive branded drugs when cheaper generic alternatives might be just as good, leading to wasted healthcare spending.
But this editorial argues against that. What's their counterargument?
Their main point is that research actually indicates these ads increase sales for both the advertised brand name drug and its generic competitors within the same drug class.
How does that work?
They use Lipitor ads as an example. Those ads apparently increase demand not just for Lipitor itself, but also for the generic competitor Zocor. The mechanism, they argue, is that the ads prompt patients who might not have sought treatment otherwise to actually go visit their doctors.
And the doctor often prescribes the generic.
Exactly. The doctor, aware of the patient's condition now, often recommends the more affordable generic option if it's appropriate. So the ad serves as a trigger for a necessary conversation.
So the potential negative impact of restricting these ads, according to the editorial, would be
that it could actually discourage people who genuinely need treatment from seeking it out in the first place. They might not realize a treatment exists or that their symptoms are treatable. And interestingly, it could also cut into the sales of unadvertised drugs that currently benefit from the increased overall awareness generated by ads for other drugs in their category.
So the implication is that we need a more nuanced view, that limiting these ads could have unintended, counterproductive public health outcomes.
That's the argument. It challenges the conventional wisdom that these ads are purely harmful. It suggests that in a world of information overload, maybe sometimes these annoying ads serve a necessary function in raising public awareness, even if their primary goal is profit.
It definitely makes you question your gut reaction, doesn't it? How does the data presented shift your perspective on those ubiquitous drug commercials? All right, let's tackle AI again, but from a different angle. An opinion piece titled, "The AI Cheating Panic is Missing the Point."
Yes, this argues that the widespread panic in schools about students using AI to cheat is actually distracting from a much more crucial conversation.
Which is
how students should be using AI, mm-hmm. how they can learn to use it effectively and ethically to prepare for a job market that's going to be increasingly shaped by this technology.
So it's focusing on the anxiety students themselves feel.
Exactly. It highlights what it calls Gen Z's dilemma. While sure, some students do cheat, the author argues most understand it's wrong. But they're facing this intense anxiety about AI reshaping their future careers. They fear being automated if they don't master AI, but also fear being professional compromised if they use it the wrong way, according to unclear rules.
And the schools aren't providing clear guidance.
Largely not yet. The piece calls it the Wild West of education policy on AI. Over half of K-12 schools apparently lack clear AI policies, and that number jumps to 67% in rural areas. This leads to student frustration, could worsen existing digital divides. School officials are just struggling to keep up with how fast AI is advancing.
So what do students actually need, according to this piece?
They want clear guidelines, first off. That's okay. Using AI to outline notes, help with math homework, suggest essay topics, but more importantly, they need courses that actively teach proper AI integration. The piece mentions Ohio State University's new AI fluency course as a positive example.
Are some educators already adapting?
Yes, some professors are already asking students to use AI for things like research, brainstorming ideas for art projects, generating writing prompts, showing that there is a pathway forward beyond just banning it.
But students still feel conflicted.
Definitely. They express both how easy AI makes some college work, but also fear that chatbots make it harder to think critically or really absorb the material. One student is quoted saying, "AI made college easier and harder at the same time."
So the call to action is for adults, educators, parents, policymakers to provide reassurance and actual guidance rather than just leaving students to navigate this massive technological revolution on their own.
Precisely. The implication is that education systems have to move beyond simply policing AI misuse. They need to proactively teach AI literacy, preparing students for a future where AI isn't the enemy, but a fundamental tool they'll be expected to use effectively and ethically.
What's fascinating here is that tension between tradition and innovation in education, isn't it? How can we ensure the next generation is equipped to thrive in an AI-powered world without compromising fundamental learning and critical thinking skills? It's a huge challenge.
Okay, one more opinion piece on AI, this one with major geopolitical implications. Trump's reversal on AI chips is a historic blunder.
Yeah, this piece argues really vehemently that President Trump's decision to allow NVIDIA to sell so-called degraded AI chips to China is a massive mistake, a historic blunder, it calls it.
Why? What's the core argument?
The argument is that this decision risks eroding America's significant lead in the AI race, essentially prioritizing NVIDIA's short-term profits over long-term national security.
What was the previous policy under the Biden administration? They implemented a ban in October 2022 on exporting advanced AI chips to China. The explicit goal was to maximize the U.S. lead in AI computing power. And according to this piece, the strategy was working. The U.S. share of global AI compute apparently rose from 51% to 74%, while China's plummeted from 33% down to 14%.
So how did NVIDIA get around this ban leading to Trump's reversal?
NVIDIA essentially created modified versions of previously banned chips, like the H20 chip. Now, they lowered the raw processing power slightly, but kept the memory very fast. This meant the chips were still capable of running advanced AI models effectively.
And the goal was specifically the Chinese market.
Yes, to gain traction in that lucrative market and technically comply with or circumvent the export controls that were in place.
And China needs these chips.
Desperately, it seems. Chinese Premier Li Xiang called the AI chip shortage a bottleneck. A leading Chinese AI firm, DeepSeek, reportedly delayed its next-generation AI model specifically due to a lack of these NVIDIA H20 chips after failing to get comparable performance from domestic Huawei chips.
So the risk of allowing these degraded chip sales is...
The author argues it allows China to achieve similar results by just using more of these slightly less powerful chips in large quantities. This significantly increases China's aggregate AI computing power, directly eroding the U.S. advantage that the previous policy was building.
The piece contrasts the economic gains versus the national interest.
It's starkly. It mentions maybe $2.5 billion in tax revenue for the U.S. government from NVIDIA's estimated $17 billion in sales to China, But contrast that with a potential $16 trillion in value added to the S&P 500 if the U.S. manages to maintain an extremely large lead in AI development overall.
It dismisses the argument that selling chips embeds U.S. tech in China.
Completely. Calls it a rehash of a failed strategy that previously helped China dominate other industries. And the possibility mentioned of allowing sales of even more advanced modified chips, like a hypothetical B-30A, is compared scathingly to Charlie Brown exercised greater caution in his attempts to kick Lucy's football.
Ouch. So what's the author's call to action?
A comprehensive block. The U.S. should prevent China from buying or accessing any U.S. AI chips or Western technology needed to make advanced chips domestically. The goal, explicitly stated, should be to make the AI competition as lopsided and unfair as possible in America's favor.
Wow. So the implication is massive. This decision is framed as a critical turning point that could really determine global AI leadership for decades to come, with profound economic and national security consequences.
Absolutely. It raises that fundamental question again. When does corporate profit become detrimental to national interest, especially in a critical, rapidly evolving field like AI? And what are the potential long-term, irreversible consequences of these kinds of policy reversals?
Okay, let's shift to the world of fashion and media. Formidable Wintour gives way to Safe Choice at Vogue.
Ah, the succession story at American Vogue. Chloe Mel, currently editor of Vogue.com and also daughter of Candice Bergen, has been named head of editorial content. She's succeeding the legendary Anna Wintour, although the role seems maybe somewhat diminished compared to Wintour's overall influence.
So, who is Chloe Mao? What's her background at Vogue?
Her career there has spanned pretty much everything. Print, digital, audio, video, events, social media. Wintour herself praised Mao for balancing Vogue's history with its future.
What's her style or known for?
The article notes she recently profiled Lauren Sanchez, Jeff Bezos' partner, and hired Jack Schlossberg, JFK's grandson, as a political correspondent. Her background and social circle apparently skew toward the highbrow celebrity adjacent, and perhaps cattily, the piece notes she is not a particularly inspiring dresser.
Oof. And there are Nepo baby accusations.
Inevitably, yes. Being the daughter of actress Candice Bergen and director Louis Malle opens her up to that criticism. The article points out similar criticisms were leveled at Vanity Fair's new leader, Mark Guiducci, who is a friend of Wintour's daughter.
What does her appointment suggest about the broader cultural climate, according to the piece?
It suggests a kind of conservatism in culture right now. Businesses turning to safer choices amid a backlash to diversity and inclusion efforts. This is particularly noted in the context of Wintour herself facing accusations of racial insensitivity a few years ago.
Were others considered frontrunners?
Black editors like Edward Enninful, who led British Vogue, or Kioma Nadi, who now heads British Vogue, were once widely considered heirs apparent to Wintour. So Mao's appointment is seen by some as a step back from that potential direction.
And what's the context at Condé Nast, Vogue's publisher?
Continual layoffs, unfortunately. Though the company is apparently breaking even now, it's still missing revenue goals. So financial pressure is likely a factor in leadership choices, too.
So the implication is that this leadership change at such an iconic fashion publication reflects these broader shifts in media and cultural values, the balance between tradition, diversity, and just basic commercial stability.
Exactly. It makes you ask, what does this change at the helm of a cultural institution like Vogue really tell us about the current state of fashion, media, and maybe even our societal priorities right now?
Okay, let's lighten the mood slightly with a look back at summer trends. Sunset on the trends of a bummer summer.
Ah, yes. A retrospective on the fleeting cultural fads of summer 2025. A summer characterized, the author says, by horror in the news, which led people to turn to candy-coated distractions. Seems we're ready to move on.
What were some of these distractions? First up, Labubu bag charms.
Right, these little plush keychains described as cute and menacing. Apparently a huge craze driven by that blind box collectible packaging and, of course, social media hype.
Will they last?
The article questions their staying power against an icon like Hello Kitty and notes there were counterfeit lefufis that posed a choking hazard. Their vibe, though, was seen as apt for a summer when an endless stream of horror in the news sent us to candy-coated distractions.
What else defined this bummer summer? The song of the summer apparently died.
Yeah, 2025 apparently saw the fewest hit songs in U.S. history reach the charts. Only one new song, Alex Warren's Ordinary, cracked the top 10, and it was described as, well, a bummer.
Why the lack of hits?
Factors cited include our fragmented culture, social media algorithms constantly shifting focus, and maybe even President Trump dominating the news cycle.
Okay, what about fashion? Denim wars.
Bizarre moment, wasn't it? Involved an American Eagle campaign with Sydney Sweeney. Sydney Sweeney has great genes. That some saw as a racist dog whistle. President Trump commenting on it. Gap running a counter ad with the girl group Cat's Eye.
All amidst anxieties about pop stars' gender politics, like Sabrina Carpenter and JoJo Siwa. And nostalgia for millennial mall culture.
Exactly. A weird confluence of things. Other trends mentioned. Leslie Bibb's short bob haircut was apparently huge. Lots of small swimwear and flip-flops correlating with record-breaking heat extending the summer feel.
And a matcha shortage.
Blamed on TikTok and, quote, performative males. Make of that what you will.
Any trends that are enduring.
Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce are dubbed the forever chemicals of our pop culture. Their engagement excitement shows no signs of dying down, apparently.
What about political trends?
California Governor Gavin Newsom adopting Trump's all-cap Pew social media style for trolling purposes. Using AI slop images to kind of meme a meme against Trump. Signaling, perhaps, newness in the blueness of political discourse. Adapting tactics.
And finally, Dubai chocolate.
Ah, yes, that viral candy bar with the green pistachio paste. Became a huge meme, seen as symbolizing TikTok's very shopping-centric social media approach and just the rapid-fire, algorithmically hyped product fads that burn bright and fade fast.
So the implication of this whole piece is it's a humorous, maybe insightful commentary on just how ephemeral internet culture is, the impact of social media, how we seek distraction in chaotic times.
Pretty much. It's a snapshot of fleeting moments. So what does it all mean for you? Which of these fads resonated, if any? And what do they tell us, if anything, about our collective search for connection, distraction, maybe meaning in 2025?
Let's move to music now. Zach Taphones, a new old school kind of country music.
Yeah, introducing Zach Top. He's a 27-year-old singer from Sunnyside, Washington, who's emerging as a pretty distinctive voice in country music.
How so? What's his style?
Well, visually, he apparently evokes those 1990s hat acts, like Alan Jackson, Clint Black, tall blue jeans, mustache, cowboy hat, that whole aesthetic.
But his sound is different.
His vocal style, according to the reviewer, is compared more to the priceless finesse of older legends like Keith Whitley, Randy Travis, Don Williams, Vern Gosden. So a blend of eras.
Interesting. What themes does he explore in his music?
His songs with titles like South of Sanity, Between the Ditches, Love and the Wrong Things, tend to explore life's hardships, wrong turns, anxious struggles, but always the reviewer notes with a quiet dignity.
And his vocal delivery contributes to that.
Yeah, the reviewer highlights the lightness in his voice, suggesting it conveys selflessness and generosity, making these potentially heavy themes feel more accessible and relatable. He apparently never seethes, pouts, or wallows, maintaining a kind of mystique likened to a smoking cowboy in the washed-out pages of an old magazine.
So the implication is that he represents a potential resurgence or maybe an evolution of traditional country music, offering a fresh take on classic sounds and storytelling.
Seems to be the idea. What's fascinating here is how artists can draw on those classic influences, creating that sense of nostalgia while still forging a unique path and sounding new. It makes you think, what draws you to music that feels both familiar and fresh at the same time?
Okay, final opinion piece. Kari Lake is wrong about China and VOA, VOA being Voice of America.
Right. This piece argues that Kari Lake's criticisms of Voice of America are misguided and actually damaging to U.S. national interests, particularly when it comes to countering Chinese Communist Party influence abroad.
Remind us, what is VOA's role?
It was established way back in 1942, initially to counter Nazi propaganda. The author argues VOA has been a most effective bulwark against Beijing's influence-seeking activities globally by promoting accurate information. During the Cold War, millions behind the Iron Curtain risked arrest just listening to VOA broadcasts.
So what were Kari Lake's specific allegations against VOA?
She accused VOA leadership of caving to pressure from Beijing. Specifically, she claimed they fired Sasha Gong, who was chief of VOA's Mandarin service, after Gong broadcast an interview with a prominent critic of the Chinese government.
But investigations didn't back that up.
Correct. According to this piece, both internal and external investigations concluded that VOA management acted appropriately in terminating Gong and upheld proper editorial standards. Lake's claims were apparently drawn from an older 2019 report, but later investigations debunked that premise.
There were also procedural issues with Lake's actions regarding VOA when she was involved in his oversight, weren't there?
Yes. A federal judge found Lake's attempt to fire the VOA director, Michael Abramowitz, was illegal. She also later issued termination notices to over 500 VOA employees, causing significant disruption.
So what's the current status of VOA's Mandarin service?
It's still operating, but apparently at a reduced rate. VOA asserts it has legal protection from the administration's efforts to eliminate it entirely.
And the author's call to action.
Specialists in Chinese politics, cited in the piece, argue VOA is a vital instrument for combating authoritarian narratives. They say it should be supported and strengthened, especially its Mandarin service, not attacked or undermined.
So the implication is that this debate highlights the critical importance of having independent, objective news sources in international relations, and the dangers of politicizing institutions specifically designed to counter foreign propaganda.
Exactly. It really raises that important question. In this era of widespread information warfare, how do we protect and strengthen institutions like VOA that are crucial for promoting truth and transparency on the global stage, especially when they come under domestic political fire?
All right, let's move into our final section. Local news, sports, lifestyle, obituaries, kind of the everyday insights. First up, a Metro story causing outrage in Alexandria, Virginia. The housing director apparently lived in a public housing unit himself.
Yeah, Eric Johnson, the CEO of Alexandria's public housing agency, ARHA. He's under investigation and on probation after discovered he was living in a public housing unit, effectively bypassing the city's decade-long waiting list.
What was his explanation?
He claimed he was just transitioning residences temporarily, but the unit he moved into was in Chatham Square, which is described as a desirable mixed-income public housing project near the waterfront. He essentially jumped a queue of thousands of people, as one critic put it. It's seen as a violation of everything ARHA is supposed to be doing.
So the implication is that this really undermines public confidence in the housing authority and just makes the challenge of providing affordable housing in a wealthy place like Northern Virginia even harder.
Absolutely. It raises serious questions about trust in local government and that ongoing struggle for equitable access to housing, especially when leaders appear to be benefiting personally.
Next Metro story, sadly, involves student safety. A student was struck by a car in a Prince George's County crosswalk.
Yes, an 11-year-old student at a charter school there was hit by a speeding car near the school. This has renewed concerns about safety at an intersection that doesn't have a crossing guard.
Where did it happen?
At the intersection of Norcross Street and St. Clair Drive, less than a block from the Imagine Lincoln Charter Public School, apparently right during dismissal time, a formal request for a crossing guard has been made.
Does the fact that it's a charter school make a difference?
It might. The article notes that charter schools often face different funding structures and resource challenges compared to traditional public schools, which could impact things like securing funding for a crossing guard position.
So the implication here highlights critical issues in pedestrian safety, especially for students near schools, and potentially inequities in resource allocation between different types of schools.
Definitely. It makes you think about how communities balance traffic safety needs with limited school resources and the role parents and communities play in advocating for safer conditions for kids.
Okay, turning to Virginia news. Amazon is set to receive its first public dollars from Arlington County for its HQ2 development.
Right, the first taxpayer subsidy payout. Arlington County will pay Amazon just over $81,000 this month. This was part of the incentive deal tied specifically to increases in hotel tax revenue generated by HQ2's presence.
How is that deal structured?
The 2018 deal anticipated that HQ2 would significantly boost hotel tax revenue in Arlington. The county agreed to pay Amazon 15% of any increase above a pre-pandemic baseline of $25 million. This fiscal year is the first time that revenue actually surpassed the baseline, hitting $25.5 million collected.
So the payout is happening now because the revenue finally increased enough. How is Amazon doing on its other promises for HQ2?
Progress is slower than initially projected. Amazon has filled only about a third of the promised 25,000 jobs so far. They've built two office towers, but the largest phase of the project hasn't even broken ground yet.
And Virginia's larger subsidies are also delayed.
Yes, the state-level incentives, which could be up to $750 million, are tied to job creation targets that haven't been met yet. Amazon's own confidence level in meeting those future job targets has apparently dropped to moderate.
So what are the implications? Was Arlington's deal well-designed?
Experts quoted say Arlington's part of the deal was actually pretty well-designed, because the payout was contingent on the county actually receiving the promised benefits in this case, increased hotel tax revenue. However, the delayed payments and the much slower job growth clearly indicate that the huge economic transformation promised with HQ2 is happening much less rapidly than initially projected. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's a really interesting case study in these large-scale economic development deals. What does it tell us about the long-term impact, the return on investment, and the accountability measures needed for these massive public incentives offered to corporations?
Okay, something a bit lighter now in the metro section. This isn't your typical reading club. Book it around DC.
Huh, yeah. This sounds interesting. It's a new club that combines monthly walks with listening to audiobooks, a unique kind of social experience for book lovers.
How does it work?
Nearly 100 people apparently showed up for a recent walk at the National Arboretum. Everyone listens to their own individual audiobook on headphones while walking together as a group.
So you're together but listening separately.
Exactly. Members say they appreciate the community aspect, feeling happier and safer walking in a group, even if they aren't constantly talking to each other. It apparently caters well to both introverts and extroverts.
And this fits into broader trends.
Yeah, the article connects it to the growing popularity of audiobooks in general, and also the rise of silent book clubs where people just read together quietly. Seems people are seeking connection, but maybe in less pressured ways, especially as pleasure reading rates have declined.
The implication is that this showcases innovative ways people are finding community and, you know, personal well-being through shared yet still individualized activities in our increasingly digital world.
Totally. What's fascinating is how simple activities, like walking or reading, can be reimagined to foster connection in new ways. Would you join a club like this? And what kind of audiobook would you listen to on a group walk?
All right, let's talk weather with the Capital Weather Gang. August in D.C. was apparently pretty unusual.
Very unusual. It was the driest August on record for D.C. Only 0.2 inches of rain the entire month. And also the coolest August in a quarter century, averaging 75.8 degrees. This is raising some drought concerns now.
Driest and coolest. How much cooler than normal was it?
August was 3.6 degrees below normal. That's the lowest average August temperature since the year 2000. Overall, it ranked as the 58th coolest August historically. But in today's generally warmer climate, that's pretty notable. Humidity was also uncharacteristically low for August.
And what's the forecast looking like for September? More of the same.
Forecasts suggest a continuation of cool and dry weather into September. It's projected to be the coolest September since 2006, maybe around 70 degrees average, and also drier than normal, perhaps 1.5 inches of rain compared to the average of nearly 4 inches.
September can sometimes be wet due to tropical systems, though.
It can be, yeah. But the models, at least for now, are showing drier than normal weather overall. It's been a real flip this summer, a hot, humid June and July, followed by this abrupt shift to cool and dry in August.
So the implication of this detailed weather recap, it highlights local climate variability, obviously, but also the potential for drought conditions developing, which can impact everything from agriculture to water resources.
Yeah, definitely. It makes you think, how do these shifts in local weather patterns impact your daily life? And what does it tell you, if anything, about the broader climate trends we're experiencing?
Moving to obituaries now, the passing of a well-known actor, Graham Greene, has died at 73.
Yes, a really prominent First Nations actor. Best known, of course, for his Oscar-nominated role as Kicking Bird in Dances with Wolves. He had a prolific career spanning 4 decades.
What were some of his other notable roles?
He was in so much. Over 200 film and television productions listed. Films like Thunderheart, Maverick, The Green Mile. More recently, The Twilight Saga, New Moon, the video game Red Dead Redemption 2, and TV shows like The Last of Us and Echo. A really recognizable face and presence.
He was a significant figure for Indigenous representation, wasn't he?
Absolutely. A major figure for Native Americans and First Nations people. He advocated for greater, more authentic representation in fiction. But he also insisted that his background shouldn't limit his acting range. There's an anecdote about him walking out of a meeting when a director apparently couldn't envision Native Americans serving on a U.S. submarine.
So his legacy underscores the importance of diverse representation in media and the impact Indigenous actors have had on the global stage.
Definitely. His career really raises that important question. How far have we actually come and how far do we still need to go in ensuring authentic and diverse representation in film and television?
Okay, into the food section now, starting with a look at Cracker Barrel's attempts to modernize. Title: Cracker Barrel is trying to modernize. Bless its heart.
Huh. Yeah, this piece looks at the controversy stirred up by Cracker Barrel's efforts to update its image and menu. Things like a new logo, which they quickly reverted in adding things like margaritas to the menu, highlighting that clash between tradition and contemporary trends.
What were the modernization efforts specifically?
Well, the chain, known for its old country store vibe, that feeling of being unstuck in time, introduced some new menu items like fried onion-topped burgers. And yes, they started serving margaritas back in 2020. They also apparently redesigned some interiors.
But the logo change caused the biggest stir.
Oh, yeah. They unveiled a new, much more minimalistic logo. It eliminated the iconic overall-wearing fellow sitting in the rocking chair. That sparked immediate outrage online from critics, including Donald Trump Jr., who called it woke.
And the company backed down quickly.
Very quickly. They reverted to the old logo, releasing a statement saying, "Uncle Herschel, he's family."
Did this whole thing have a political or market impact?
The debate went totally viral. Even involved rival chain Steak and Shake and the Democratic Party's official X account weighing in. Cracker Barrel's stock briefly fell. President Trump himself advised them to go back to the old logo, admit a mistake.
What's the reporter's take on it? They seem to be a fan of the old Cracker Barrel.
Yeah, the reporter, a self-professed Cracker Barrel fan, views modernization as almost antithetical to the chain's core appeal as a refuge for modern life. They feel the awkward blend of old and new makes the place feel lost now.
So the implication of this amusing yet kind of insightful story, it reveals the challenges of brand identity, doesn't it? The power of nostalgia and just the unpredictable nature of internet-fueled public opinion in our rapidly changing cultural landscape.
Absolutely. It makes you ask, when does a beloved brand change too much? When is it necessary for survival? And maybe how much power should viral outrage really have over corporate decisions? Bless its heart, indeed.
Sticking with food, celebrity chef Marcus Samuelson has a new restaurant in D.C., Marcus D.C., and it features a special roast chicken.
Yes, Chuck B's roast chicken. It comes with a complex take on mumbo sauce, described as an ode to the city's culture and a classic D.C. culinary standby.
So he's drawing on local inspiration?
Definitely. Samuelson said he aimed for a menu rooted in the DMV, D.C., Maryland, Virginia local culture. He apparently started with music, specifically Chuck Brown, the godfather of go-go music, hence the Chuck B name.
And the mumbo sauce, how is his version different? Mumbo sauce is a big deal in D.C.
It is. Samuelson's version apparently elevates it significantly. He starts by sautéing shallots, Fresno chiles, and ginger, then adds ketchup, pineapple juice, gochujang, the Korean chili paste, sugar, apple cider vinegar, honey, soy sauce, lemon juice, and cayenne.
Wow, that's a lot of ingredients.
Yeah, the idea is to create layers of sweetness, spice, acidity, and those savory fermented notes from the gochujang and soy sauce that you rarely find in other, often simpler versions of mumbo sauce.
How is the chicken itself cooked at the restaurant?
They sous vide the chicken first for moisture. Then they brush it with the sauce and blast it in a scorching hot oven to get that caramelization on the skin. It's served with a salad of radicchio, herbs, carrots, and dukkah, an Egyptian nut and spice blend, to add freshness and texture.
So the implication here is showcasing how high-end culinary creativity can still respect and elevate local food traditions, offering new interpretations of familiar flavors.
Exactly. What's fascinating is how a chef can take a beloved, maybe sometimes humble local dish and add these new layers of flavor and cultural meaning. Mm-hmm. It makes you think, what local flavors from your own area would you love to see reimagined by a top chef?
Okay, our final food story looks at a high-profile shift in the fine dining world. 11 Madison Park in New York, the renowned 3-star Michelin restaurant, is retreating from its fully vegan menu.
Yeah, this is pretty big news in the food world. It reflects the significant uphill battles that purely plant-based fine dining can face, even at the very highest level.
So what's the change? Are they abandoning veganism completely?
Not completely, but it's a definite reversal. Chef Daniel Hum will debut a new tasting menu on October 14th that's flexible enough for both vegans and omnivores. Diners will apparently be able to select meat or seafood for certain courses if they wish. This ends his 4.5-year experiment with a fully vegan menu, which he started back in 2021, citing environmental reasons.
And peers in the meatless dining world weren't surprised by this move.
Apparently not. The article cites several challenges specific to high-end vegan dining, things like potentially lower alcohol sales, less pairing with rich meats, significantly higher labor costs. The example given from another vegan restaurant, Durkami, is 60% labor costs just to transform vegetables into these intricate dishes.
And the target audience is small?
Tiny, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
Only about 2.5% of U.S. adults identify as vegan or vegetarian. Plus, there's a public perception issue. People often expect vegetables to be cheap, making it hard to justify the very high prices necessary for fine dining labor and ingredients, even if they're plant-based.
Labor-intensive. Can you give an example?
Rob Rubba from Oyster Oyster, another respected D.C. restaurant, illustrates it. A small nest made from celery root apparently requires at least 4 hours of active labor for just one dinner service. Peeling, slicing, frying components, making purees, just for one element of one dish.
Did Chef Hum acknowledge any mistakes with the original vegan menu?
He did. He apparently said the fully vegan menu unintentionally alienated people and maybe limited creativity in some ways, and he confirmed that wine sales were down. Another chef quoted Amanda Cohen from Dirk Candy, argued one of Hum's biggest mistakes was not lowering the price when they went plant-based. 11 Madison Park kept charging the same $335 per person for the vegan menu as they had for their previous meat-inclusive menu.
And this isn't the only setback for high-end vegan dining recently.
No, the article also mentions that the Planted chain of upscale vegan restaurants recently filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
So the implication of this high-profile shift at 11 Madison Park, it really underscores the tough economic realities and maybe consumer preferences that make dedicated, purely plant-based fine dining a particularly difficult venture, even for the most talented chefs with the best resources.
It seems so. It raises that important question. Is truly high-end, exclusively plant-based dining sustainable as a business model right now? What does this tell us about consumer expectations for value and maybe the future direction of fine dining overall? #TechTagOutro.
Wow, what an incredible journey through today's Washington Post.
Yeah.
Just so much ground covered from the halls of power, you know, with those unprecedented federal interventions and high-stakes antitrust rulings, to the front lines of global conflicts, the shifting landscapes of our economy, our culture. We've really seen a world in flux today.
Yeah, indeed. We've explored how technology is just reshaping everything, haven't we? From, you know, warfare and national security to our job searches, how historical injustices and political battles continue to demand attention, and how even our everyday choices, what we eat, the brands we interact with, reflect these deeper societal currents.
Yeah, every story, no matter how seemingly small, like that Cracker Barrel logo, offers a window into this complex tapestry of 2025.
That's right.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? As we navigate this constant flow of information, these deep dives hopefully reveal that behind every headline, there are these intricate connections, often surprising implications, and almost always a very human story. The news isn't just about what happened yesterday. It's really about what's next and how we choose to engage with it, how we understand it.
Precisely. I mean, consider the ripple effects of that decision made in a DC courtroom about Google, reaching all the way to your search results. Or the simple, profound act of a drone delivering comfort, a Snickers bar even, to a soldier in a trench halfway across the world. What questions do these stories spark for your own community, maybe your career, or just your understanding of the world? We really encourage you to keep asking those questions, keep looking beneath the surface, and keep diving deeper.
Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive. Until next time, stay curious.
And stay informed.